Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast. Back in Studio A, and welcome to my guest this morning. Archaeologist Paul Reed is joining us, of course, from his home in the Taos area. And Paul, good morning. Good to see you and hear you. I think we can hear you anyway. Good morning.
Yeah, great to be here, Scott. Good morning.
We got you. Good to see you. Thank you, Paul. And always great to have you on the program to talk a little bit about your industry, your career, your field. And we've talked a lot about indigenous impacts in archaeology. And that's kind of our topic today, are some of the indigenous peoples that are getting more into your field. And that's a really good thing.
Right. It definitely is. Yeah, we've talked a lot about archaeology as a whole and anthropology making a transition away from sort of a Euro-American centered to a more indigenous native centered, you know, focus. And I think, you know, again, it's a real exciting time to be doing this.
Right. And because for a long time, in fact, for most of its history, right, it was maybe a more European, Western dominated field, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. You know, as we talk about, you know, different issues in America and sort of the effects of colonialism, archaeology and anthropology has been somewhat unintentionally in part, and I think at other times very intentionally, sort of a major tool of Euro-Americans deciding how, you know, life was going to work in North America and the United States and other places. So part of the transition we're making now is just stepping away from that and really trying to recenter indigenous and native views, you know, of culture and heritage in a lot of the areas, you know, that I work with and others do.
Right, right. And you sent an article to me from Berkeley about just the views about how the land is treated as well, right? There are really specific and deep-seated views about how we treat the land, or how indigenous peoples treat the land, as opposed to how maybe Western cultures treat the land. And that's a really interesting difference.
Right. No, I think in some ways, this is what I talk about, you know, in this realm as sort of the clash of cultures, if you will, because I think indigenous and native folks really think about the land as a living thing. So this includes, you know, the topography, the hillsides, the mountains, the water, the plants, the animals, really everything that makes up land, you know, as we encounter it in our world. And I think on sort of the Euro-American worldwide, it's more about, we look at land, okay, I can build a house here, you know, I can find resources here, and of course other people want resources too, but then the next step is, you know, how do I sort of take advantage of or exploit land? So I think in some ways that's a pretty fundamental difference as we look at worldview, essentially. And again, sort of back to the idea of a clash of culture and worldview. So that's what makes the time that we're in, I think, really dynamic, as those of us who are trying to be part of a transition in a very respectful and ethical way figure out how to navigate these worlds.
Right. And some of these things, I think, are already coming into play, right, in the field of archaeology, from just taking a bulldozer at a site, right, and just seeing what you can dig up or run across. And from an indigenous point of view, you know, that is you know, really not treating Mother Earth with respect and things along that line. And I think even in the archaeological field, it's been a lot more trying to do less harm and be very strategic in how you uncover some of these buried sites and things along that line. Does that make sense, what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, definitely, Scott. And that's something that's highlighted in the article as well. Again, this is from the UC Berkeley News. talking about a real shift in archaeology, and the individual who one of the individuals highlighted in the article is Professor Kent Lightfoot, who was a really, really good friends with my mentor at New Mexico State, you know, many eons ago. An individual name was Stedman Upham, you know, who was a researcher studying different cultures of the Southwest. Well, Kent Lightfoot worked with Stead, and they were close associates, got their degrees at Arizona State University in 1980. And then Kent went to California and started developing programs. And in this article, he talks about his own personal evolution from, you know, this is the way we did archaeology. We got out the heavy equipment and looked at sites. And then we felt like we had the right, essentially, to dig any archaeological site because we're scientists and we're trying to do science the way that we've been trained as archaeologists. So it's very interesting to me for him, you know, this individual Kent Lightfoot, to talk about this transition, because he's basically learned from working with the indigenous people of California that the sites are viewed as living organisms, and that, you know, there's pain and trauma and things that happen from disturbing those sites that affect the living people, you know, who are still here today, if these are their ancestral sites, and even if they're not directly linked. So, yeah, it seems like this, you know, it's been a real impactful transition for him. And as we've talked on the show before, it definitely has for me as well as an archaeologist.
Right, right. Well, and again, you've brought in a lot of guests to the program who talk about their, you know, their current peoples linked to these sites that we're all familiar with, like Chaco Canyon and other places here in the Southwest. And so even maybe if there's not direct correlation, they still have that some connection to these sites, and they're very sacred and important to those cultures, and need to be treated with respect. And that seems to be part of this whole new idea of how archaeologists go about their work, and how these new field or new generation of indigenous archaeologists are looking at the field as well. And I think that's got to be gratifying to you to see some of these newer folks studying the field and getting into the field and being your colleagues with Native American backgrounds and culture and knowledge.
Yeah, definitely has, Scott. That's been one of the most exciting things for me over the last dozen or so years, is to work with a number of individuals who've grown up in both worlds, in their tribal worlds, and then gone off to university and college and learned, you know, sort of the Euro-American white man's archaeology, if you will, and then the way these individuals blend that and try to understand their own history, their own heritage, their own culture, drawing upon what they've learned, may have learned in more traditional settings at home, and then what they're learning, you know, in this the more archaeological scientific realm, and then trying to sort of merge or blend those views, which is quite challenging, again, sort of back to the clash of worldviews and how we do that. But yeah, it's been a really, for me, a real exciting role to have, is in whatever way that I can sort of help individuals come along and do this, and as well as the evolution in my own work and how I think about it. So yeah, again, I think it's a really exciting dynamic time.
Right. And have these new students and younger archaeologists been able to teach even someone like you a thing or two about the work that you have been doing and will be doing?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and I think that that's kind of the fun part of this for me is, you know, I wouldn't describe it necessarily as a complete reinvention for me, but it's been a very expansive change in the way I think about how anthropology and archaeology should be practiced in an ethical way. And really, you know, in our organization at Archaeology Southwest, you know, Tucson based, of course, and what we've been doing down there in hiring quite a few more indigenous staff, we've discussed last fall with my colleagues Skylar Begay and Ashley Thompson, and really just trying to totally recenter the way our organization thinks about the practice of archaeological work, cultural work, anthropology, and, you know, and museum work and archival work as well, and how to, if we're going to go work in an area, you know, who should we talk to? Who are the folks, the indigenous groups, the native groups still on the landscape in these different areas? You know, number one, what are their interests in this heritage? Number two, can we work together and design a project that isn't just about extracting information and data in a scientific archaeological way, but also is seen by the groups on the land today as a benefit to the processes they're going through? And then how do we design a project that can incorporate both of these views? And, you know, and if we go into an area and we're talking about a project and there is not support or interest, then maybe we rethink that and, you know, we go back to the drawing board, you know, have another meeting or two or several and say, you know, we're real interested in this, but we can see that there's other perspectives that need to come in. So what's the best way for us to do that? You know, and there have been groups, of course, that we've talked to who've said, you know, this is not something that we're ready to do. We're not ready to partner with anthropologists and archaeologists on this. So, you know, sometimes, again, we'll move on to a different project, or we may find another group in the area with linkage who is more interested in partnering and talking about that. So, you know, we really look at this as an ongoing process with a whole lot of dialogue and frequent checking in. And again, hopefully ending up at a point where if as we're going through a project and, you know, the process of that, that everyone involved feels like they have had significant input on the direction of the project. And then as we get down to, you know, what are the results? What's the outcome of the project? That we're not just doing that, well, we're going to put together an academic paper and it'll be published in this journal. You know, what we found in working with tribes is that isn't really much of a payoff. It's not much of a benefit ultimately for the tribes to have an article about some part of their heritage go into a journal that sits on a shelf and potentially a couple hundred people look at it. You know, so we're trying to, again, expand this and not have the archaeologists, the scientists really just sort of corner this data and say, this is for us. So, and that's, but that's difficult because people have been doing this for decades and centuries. So we're sort of untangling that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, right. And it brings to me the thought of trust as well. We've talked about that before, I know, on this program as well. But in order to kind of move forward with some of these partnerships and understandings, I think there needs to be a level of trust, right, between archaeologists and agencies and these tribal entities as well to make these things kind of go forward because of the past in certain circumstances and maybe some other issues that are going on, right?
That's right. You know, one of the, we talk about a different approach to doing this, how we want to handle that. And really the first thing that we talk about is relationships. So it's very important to build relationships and then have individuals representing different tribes, either formally or perhaps informally, understand that we're, the relationship is something that we're very interested in doing. And again, it has to be seen as a reciprocal relationship. That's another one of the key tenets of this approach, is that we're not just going in and sort of trying to glad handle people and say, hey, this will be great. It'll, you know, we'll come back and we'll do this. You know, your tribal members could potentially work on a project. We'll pay wages. And then we go and we take artifacts away. We take research away and we send them back maybe a very lengthy project report that may or may not be really of interest specifically to different members. So the idea is to turn that around and go, what are the products of this work that would be very helpful in education? Can we make an educational video that would be appropriate to show? You know, there's projects like this that have happened with the Hopi tribe, where groups went in and did projects, and then a key component of that was an educational side to actually produce some curriculum working with Hopi teachers to say, hey, this would really help me reach, you know, my fifth graders or my eighth graders. So yeah, that's, it's a more involved process, and, but I think it's a, there's a much greater payoff ultimately in terms of building the relationships, building the trust. And again, you know, as we've talked many times on the show, Scott, repairing some of the damage that has been done by people going into tribal communities and extracting different things and really not giving anything back that, that is valued in those communities.
Right, right. We have talked about that a lot. And I wanted to ask you, though, too, with this new kind of enlightenment, if you will, in the field, is this being accepted by most in the industry? Is it still kind of a selling going on to maybe change people's mindsets about working with indigenous people in North America and elsewhere in the world, I suppose, too, right? Because that hasn't happened in other places of the world either, has it?
No, and it is really a worldwide process that, you know, obviously I'm most familiar with the Southwestern work and, you know,
sure.
colleagues who are working here. But yeah, I think we've got, you know, we could use different buzzwords, buy-in. I think we have, many, many archaeologists who want to embrace this and head down this path. And in particular, you know, not surprisingly, as you know, a lot of the change that we see in any field, industry, discipline, process is with younger people. So, you know, the younger people that I'm associated with, I've done different projects with, who are my friends, who've come up and done graduate work, you know, since the year 2000 or even 2010, they have a very different attitude towards this. And they've learned in graduate school that archaeology has changed. So for them, it's less of a, hey, maybe we should change it. So in talking to friends and colleagues who are in this age range, you know, 30s and 40s, they've already seen the change happen. And as they, you know, sort of go into their careers, get teaching positions and other positions where they'll be able to have positive influence on the directions, I'm very, very optimistic about that. You know, if, as with any field, I think there is what I would describe probably as an old guard, right? People who are my age and older, who think that, you know, archaeology is great. This is what we, you know, archaeology, the way we've done it for 50 years is great. We should keep doing this. I do feel that that group, you know, we continue to work on them with outreach, but some of that is just a matter of carrying out our careers, moving on to whatever awaits them post-retirement and getting, you know, sort of the fresh blood up. So this is how the world evolves and changes. But I am very optimistic working with younger colleagues and really a lot of people my age and older who are also ready to really take this on and bring this about. Because the other issue is we learn a lot and we train in anthropology. And I learned this, you know, even 40 years ago in graduate school that, you know, this is a social justice issue as well. And this isn't just about how are we going to be the best possible researchers or scientists, but that how are we going to have positive impact on people's lives? And so that's, you know, I think people might describe this as an activist side of anthropology and cultural work, but this is a very, very important part of it for most of my colleagues. So I think we recognize that social justice connection, and we're trying really hard to do our work in a responsible and respectful and ethical way that, again, produces tangible benefits for communities. So I think most folks are on board with that.
Right, right. And like any industry, I would say, too, it evolves over time. Archaeology being no different than broadcasting or journalism or anything else, medical, legal, all the other careers you can think of, right, evolve over time with new thoughts and new information and new thinking about how we do the jobs that we do. And yours is no different, I would think. So that's really important. But when you look around the world, there is a lot of, you know, a lot of similar stories in other parts of the world, aren't there, with how indigenous people were treated and those sites were treated. I'm thinking maybe, you know, South America and places like that, and even Africa. And maybe that's also part of a new thinking of bringing some of those peoples into the conversations, I hope in some small or not so small way.
Right, definitely. You know, friends who work in other contexts, they work in Egypt, Peru, parts of Africa, they're on projects where they have local colleagues, you know, who have advanced training, master's degrees or PhDs connected to their local universities who are running those projects. So we have much more of a collaborative approach to doing archaeology and anthropology worldwide. And again, this is disentangling from, you know, the colonial sort of exploitative past. And so I think, yeah, I think this trend is ongoing worldwide. And I think really important evolution in how that's done, and just recentering indigenous people worldwide as they discuss their heritage, how they want to manage artifacts that are in museums, the narratives that are written, you know, negotiating, writing their multiple histories. And again, I think that's hugely important.
Right. And Paul, what would you say if you have any words of advice for a young student, maybe, who's maybe listening to us, watching us this morning, and always interested in archaeology or anthropology and getting into the field? It would seem like for a Native American student, there may be a lot of opportunities for them in the years to come because of this new mindset and new collaborative efforts in the field.
Yeah, most definitely. You know, I would encourage young Indigenous or Native students to think about, you know, how they would like to contribute to better interpreting, you know, their own tribal heritage, their own histories, and really to think of this sort of as a dual track process where, you know, depending upon how they've grown up, they have traditional connections, they understand some of what's going on, they're learning from their elders in a community. If they can go to universities in the Southwest and partner, you know, as students, but partner with mentors and professors, then they can learn, you know, the professional side of it and then put those together. And this is really what we're seeing more and more with many of the positions. You know, many of the tribes have their own historic preservation programs and cultural programs headed up by individuals from that tribe, and groups will pull in expertise as they need it, either the anthropological or archaeological side. But more and more programs are coming on that have Indigenous Native folks in charge of managing their land, their own lands, how their heritage is presented, how museums are developed. So yeah, I think it's really a great time to be a young Indigenous Native person interested in understanding their own heritage and really, you know, bringing up the voices, helping to get the voices that we haven't heard out into the public sphere. And then helping, you know, on a more private or confidential side as well with their own communities. Because one of the things I often hear from the folks I work with, particularly in Pueblo communities in New Mexico and folks out at Hopi, is that, you know, some of their culture is passing onward as folks age and the language isn't being learned as much by younger people. So I think there's a lot of opportunity to really encourage much more connection for folks with their heritages and doing it in these different ways.
Right, right. You mentioned even already at Archaeology Southwest, where you work, and I imagine maybe at other firms as well, the hiring of Indigenous students, Indigenous graduates to work side by side with you and others on some of these projects and provide insights and things like that. That seems to be happening more and more these days.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And we're also seeing this not just in our world, in the nonprofit world, but in, you know, the more contract archaeology, cultural resource management world, you know, and most of the jobs in archaeology are in different federal agencies. And I know you know, the feds are very interested in bringing Indigenous folks into their ranks as well. So, yeah, I think it's a really exciting time again to be part of this transition and kind of seeing where we're going to be in 10, 15, 20 years.
Right. And that was going to be my next question to you, was some of these contracts that you may have with the federal government or even state governments of doing some of the digs and explorations for road projects, for example, or a building project and things. And do they require, to have some Native American or Indigenous, input on your staff as you do that? Or do you expect to see maybe more of those requirements moving forward?
Yeah, I would hope so, Scott. You know, the work that I do is pretty much out of that realm at this point. When I worked for Navajo Nation as an archaeologist and developed a program specifically doing roads archaeology in the 90s, we were very focused on that. 90% of our staff was from the Navajo Nation when we were doing those projects. And that was really an important early program, I think, to train Indigenous youth and other folks in learning about that. But yeah, so I don't do really a lot of cultural resource management anymore. It's more partnering with federal agencies to do different aspects of landscape and culture. But in that world, in what we call, you know, the acronym, the CRM world, they are trying to do that. I feel myself that they're still fairly focused on an archaeologically based model of, you know, here are artifacts on the ground, this is how we want to manage it. When they do bring in tribes to look at things, and they did this on the really large Bureau of Rec project, the Navajo Gallup Water Supply Project, when they had Acoma and Zuni and Hopi and Navajo individuals out looking at the landscape, they learned so much more about those places than they could have learned just with a strict archaeological approach. So this is something that a lot of us have been advocating for very strongly. And, you know, but this is about getting the federal agencies that regulate this to think about doing cultural work in a more expansive way. And I think they're trying to do that, but there's a whole lot of institutional inertia, you know, with the way things get managed and how reports come in and what they expect to see and those types of issues. So I'm optimistic that that'll continue to evolve, but I a somewhat faster evolution, to be honest, in that realm.
Right. Well, and there's dollars attached to that too, right? I mean, it may be a little more of an expensive project if you need to have maybe five people on a site rather than three or something to that effect. There are some dollars involved too, right?
Yeah, that's right. But there's also a whole lot of work that goes on with archaeological excavation that could potentially be shifted towards more cultural ethnographic work with tribes that would lead some of that funding. And so, you know, they are very worried about that funding issue, but I think there can be some creative solutions ultimately. One of the things I wanted to call out here, Scott, is I know we're getting to the end of our time.
Yes.
In this particular article, you know, Berkeley, of course, works in different places. One individual, Dr. Sunseri, is working at the Pueblo of Abiquiu. And so as we had done our show with Star of Freedom in June, with her Abiquiu connections, you know, she was aware of this project. And so I wanted to highlight that as well, because the work that's being done on that project is specifically about understanding, you know, Hanizero indigenous community focus with not really a whole lot of with local people. And there is a UC Berkeley graduate student whose name is Marino Baca, who is from that community and is sort of taking that on. And he was born in the Española area, has deep roots in Abiquiu. So, yeah, I just wanted to kind of call that out. And folks can, of course, see this if they pick up the article and read it. But this again, is really, for me, the best way to do community archaeology is, you know, to connect with folks, to build those relationships and say, hey, we'd like to better understand this history. What are you interested in? So I think this one is very much driven by local folks who are interested.
Very true. Well, I appreciate you bringing that to our attention this morning, Paul Reed, and great discussion as always. You know, a lot of exciting things happening in your career and your field, and we appreciate you sharing it with us each and every month. Thank you so much.
Well, my pleasure, Scott. Thank you for having me on.
You bet. Good to see you. That's Paul Reed, my guest this morning here on KSJE. Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.